I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest has written a piece recently titled, Why Bullying Needs More Efforts to Stop It. He writes, the tragic consequences of bullying have become a regular part of the news cycle. In April, an eighth grade girl in Missouri and a sixth grade boy in Pennsylvania committed suicide. Bullying was an important factor, according to their families. There are all kinds of federal agencies, state legislatures, schools grappling with how to address the problem. It's pervasive. It often causes harm. And we're going to be talking about the insights that come from a new report from the National Academies of Sciences and Engineering and Medicine related to bullying. And our guest this hour worked on that. Our guest is Jonathan Todres. He's a professor of law at Georgia State University and does a lot of research on issues related to children's rights and child well-being. He served as a member of the Committee on the Biological and Psychosocial Effects of Peer Victimization, Lessons for Bullying Prevention of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. And he's co-author of Human Rights in Children's Literature, Imagination, and the Narrative of Law. Whenever we do a show on bullying, I'm just amazed how many people call in with these vivid memories of the time, it may have been 40 years ago or 30 years ago, when you were bullied and you remember it. It stays in your mind for a long period of time, so there's no doubt in my mind that it has long-lasting effects. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, Professor Todres. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Jonathan Todres, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me on the show, and thank you, more importantly, for drawing attention to this issue.
Yeah, our pleasure. It's an important issue. Let's talk about the significant short and long-term adverse consequences for the targets, for the perpetrators, and for others who witness bullying. What did you learn that was new to you when you served on that committee?
Well, I think one of the things that surprises many people is that all individuals involved in bullying suffer adverse consequences. We often think of the target of bullying as the one who suffers, and those individuals certainly do. They suffer physical health consequences, mental health consequences, some of which, as you alluded to, last well into adulthood. But also those who bully suffer consequences, and bystanders who witness bullying and witness that violence suffer as well.
Mm-hmm. You talk about in your article, the past 15 years, all the states in the country have adopted or revised anti-bullying laws. Where is it doing well? Where do we need to improve what we're doing?
Well, I think what's exciting is that all 50 states are now engaged in this issue, and we recognize this. There's growing recognition that this is not merely a rite of passage in childhood, but this is really a public health issue. Where we need more work in all 50 states is really evaluating, are the laws that we've adopted making the difference we want to see? And I think the answer is really unknown at this stage. There are a handful of evaluations, but in most states we just don't have the answer yet as to what impact the law has had.
What laws are there?
Well, so there are a couple of tiers of law. First of all, at the federal level, there's anti-harassment, anti-discrimination law that protects individuals from behaviors that include bullying. But within each state, most of the state laws are really aimed at creating a framework, and many of them really are a call for school districts and individual schools to develop policies. So they provide an overarching framework of what should be done, but then we see a lot of diversity among the different school districts as to how they choose to implement that law.
Mm-hmm. Another area that seems to be rather new is this area of cyberbullying. There is so much time spent with social media, an incredible amount of time young people spend online. Older people do, too. I spend a lot of time online, which makes it all kind of tricky, doesn't it? You call for media companies to become involved in some way in dealing with this issue. How does bullying manifest itself online, and what in the world do you do about that?
It's a challenge. It's a real challenge. It changes. In some ways, it is best viewed as just another location, another space where children spend time. And they spend, as you said, a lot of time these days. So in certain respects, we should just think of cyberbullying as this other location. And bullying happens in schools. It happens in neighborhoods and communities. And it happens online in this sort of virtual world. So in that respect, it's not that different. But there are a couple of things that make it really different, particularly from the perspective of the target of bullying, and that is the sort of 24/7 nature of the online world gives many targets a sense that they just simply cannot escape. For more traditional forms, they maybe felt if once they left school, they were somewhat removed, although still suffering in many ways. But the social media environment creates a sense that there's, for many, they feel that they cannot escape at all. And then it really presents a big challenge for us on the other end of the spectrum, which is responding to the problem. Schools are really struggling to figure out how best to address this because many of the behaviors and a lot of the activity that happens online happens when kids are not at school. So is that something that the school should police? Does it have the capacity to police that? And how do they do that effectively? And there we see a difference in a number across different states. Some states require their bullying laws apply to or really focus on school grounds, school events, whereas others are much broader in their scope and covering anything that might have adverse consequences and disturb the school environment. And so that could be something that does happen off campus, but that has real broad implications potentially for what a school is supposed to do, and then also for students' privacy and other issues.
Mm-hmm. Your report urges social media companies to develop policies and programs for preventing, identifying, and responding to bullying on their platforms. Is that easier said than done? Is that a pretty simple thing for social media companies to do?
All of this work is easier said than done,
I'm sure.
It is. I think that we see varying responses from social media companies already, and I think what we hope to see and what the report called for is that consistently all social media companies are focused on this, that they make their policies public, that they post them online. And one of the reasons and the value of doing that is that policymakers, concerned school administrators, teachers, parents can take a look at those and say, okay, do we think those companies are doing enough? And I think we've moved, not just in the bullying context, but in many contexts, past the idea that private companies are simply private and have no broader responsibility. I think this is a public issue, a health issue that affects many of the people who are on their platforms. And so I think they are often not only having a responsibility here, but also the best positioned in many ways to identify and respond to bullying that's taking place on their platform.
Are you aware of any of these media companies that do post their policies online?
There are some that are posted there online. I think what we'd hope for, I'm not a social media expert, so I don't sort of have a list in front of me of the different companies. But I think one of the things that's important is when they post online is that there's real specificity and as to what they are doing. I personally appreciate when somebody takes a public stand and says, we're opposed to this and we're taking action. But we hope that when policies are developed, that they have much more specificity and say exactly what they're doing to root out bullying behavior on their platform.
The reporter, your article, says that a lot of school administrators and many teachers really have trouble identifying bullying and figuring out how to successfully intervene. Is it that hard to identify bullying behavior?
I think we're in an interesting transitional period, and so I think for some teachers, it certainly is. On each end of the spectrum, with peer interaction in schools and in community centers and other locations, there are clearly behaviors that are just okay, that are fine, no issue, and then there are clearly behaviors that none of us would dispute are bullying. The challenge is that middle group where there's some gray area, and I think a lot of teachers have expressed concerns that it's unclear sometimes what is simply playful interaction and when it becomes bullying, and how best to intervene. And so I think one of the things that our committee report calls for that we felt was particularly important is that we make sure that all professionals and volunteers, and so that might include volunteer coaches and the like, all professionals and volunteers who work directly with children are provided bullying prevention training so that they have a clearer sense of what to look for, and not only when to intervene, but what they are supposed to do when they intervene.
Our guest this hour is a professor of law at Georgia State University, Jonathan Todres. He served as a member of the Committee on the Biological and Psychosocial Effects of Peer Victimization, Lessons for Bullying Prevention of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. And we're talking about bullying prevention this hour of the show. Welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655. And let's start our calls with Andrea in Minocqua. Hi, Andrea. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to state that children are not born to be bullies. It's a behavior that's learned. And when we're looking at bullying, we have to look at where are they learning this attitude, this behavior. And one of the obvious ones is the computer games that children are exposed to today. They learn to bully on those games, but also they learn to bully from each other. And somewhere along the way, some adults are teaching them to be bullies, and probably by example, with their own behavior, with the adult behavior. Also, I think that probably we have a lot of people in our country who value this behavior, as evidenced by their support of certain presidential candidate who exhibits strong bullying tactics.
Yeah, we've had several calls, actually, from people who are wondering how the rise of Donald Trump, and some would say he has bullying behavior, might influence people now in the younger generation. Professor?
I think it's an important question. There's no doubt adults model behavior and children pick up on it, and they do so, as every parent knows, they do so much more keenly than we often think they are observing. And so I think that the public discourse has certainly become much more aggressive, and you could say that there are many more examples in the public discourse of bullying, lack of accountability. That certainly sends a message to young people. I think the caller raises a really important question as to where bullying behaviors are learned. And they are learned just as tolerance can be learned. And so we ought to be asking those questions as well, that sort of root cause questions. Why is it we are modeling bullying and aggressive behaviors as opposed to sort of more tolerant behaviors? Why is it that bullies are often popular in their sort of social communities? And that's a question that we haven't answered yet.
That's an interesting question, isn't it? I guess I didn't realize that was true, that they're often popular.
It is, and I think it's something that merits more examination. Why is it that behavior doesn't immediately lead to peers, or in the case of the caller's point about presidential candidates, why it doesn't lead to potential voters just distancing themselves from that person and saying, that's not a behavior we support, and we don't want to spend time with a person like that. So I think that definitely is one of the sort of underlying questions that we need to explore further. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Andrea, for your call. Jess in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
I can relate to this subject because I was bullied as a kid growing up, and in the 70s, it was completely different than how things are today with the social media. I mean, it was more physical and intimidation versus the social media where you have no control over where it goes and what it does. After high school, though, I joined the Navy and bulked up a little bit. I worked years in construction. So as I got bigger, I started running into some of the people who used to do the bullying, and then all of a sudden they were your best friends. They didn't want to mess with you anymore. But it raised me to be a man that bullies bullies. And it doesn't have to be physical, but you don't take crap from anybody anymore. It doesn't matter who it's from. It could be anybody abusing their position, whether it's a boss or a supervisor or just somebody in a bar somewhere. And they think because they're bigger than somebody, there's always somebody bigger, there's always somebody tougher.
Right.
And it's based on somebody's circumstance, how they're going to react to a challenge.
And when you run into these people who bullied you when you were younger, do they remember they bullied you? Do you call them out on that, or you just not say anything?
I don't call them out to relive junior high,
right,
because, you know, we're adults now. But,
right,
yeah, they do remember because, oh, yeah, I remember you from school because, and then they know where you stand. And if you're double their size now, where before you were skinny little whatever, you know, they're, oh, well, yeah, oh, it's good to see you, and, oh, you know, all the things.
Right. Professor Todres.
Yeah, I mean, I think that reaction is, that's not an atypical story, and I think that the reaction, you know, the sort of, I now stand up to bullies, you know, we want people to stand up to bullies. I think we also have to be careful sort of that in standing up to bullies, we don't end up bullying, because that sort of just perpetrates that cycle. And I'm not suggesting that the caller was doing that, but I think that's one of the sort of balancing acts that, you know, we want to stand up to bullies and say that that's not acceptable, but recognize that, as we started the show and talking about the consequences for all the individuals involved, that often bullies are acting out as a result of something, and in fact they are suffering as well. Now that doesn't mean that their actions are acceptable, but that maybe we can understand their actions. And many of the people involved in this are both in kids who bully and have themselves been bullied, so they've been on both sides of this dynamic at different points. And so I think it turns out to be really complex in many instances, and some of the bullies have really suffered, and their aggressive behavior is a result of some unfortunate instances and experiences before then. And so, you know, we ought to be addressing that underlying issue as well.
Mm-hmm. So that those who bully can also suffer some pretty significant mental health consequences, right?
That's right. That's right.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about why bullying needs more efforts to stop it. Jonathan Todres is our guest, professor of law at Georgia State University, and served as a member of the Committee on the Biological and Psychosocial Effects of Peer Victimization, Lessons for Bullying Prevention of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open for you right now if you'd like to share your remedies or your experiences in this all-too-pervasive area of bullying. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. where we always love to read your comments, and we're on Twitter, and that's at Kay Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. We go to Dean in Pulaski next. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I wanted to share a personal experience with this. My son went to a private school. He started out in kindergarten with a class of 21, and 11 children left that, his class. We know of personally six that were bullied by the same child. Now, my son was bullied, too. And his grades went down. We tried to talk to the school. They did nothing. We pulled him out of that school. He is in a public school now. It infuriates me that these private schools get vouchers and yet they're not accountable. Now, if this would happen in a public school, it would be dealt with immediately, in my opinion. And, it's so sad. It just hurts. I don't think it'll ever go away. We try to actually avoid going by the church and the school. That's how much it hurts. And thank God my son's grades have went way up. And, he started in karate 4 years ago. He just said to us one day, he wants to go to karate, and he has so much confidence now. He's almost a black belt. And that's my story, and I just don't understand why they didn't do anything, Mm-hmm. And it finally stopped when I said, if this happens again, I'm calling the police, and I'm going to have them go to school. And it did stop then.
Professor Tadros.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caller's story is, it's positive in hearing how things really ended in a better place. But it's heartbreaking to hear these stories, and they're tragically far too many of these stories. I think that what we see is, and I don't know the specifics of the case, obviously, but often schools don't know quite how to react. In cases like this, you often see the schools don't know what exactly is the right intervention. We know many schools are under-resourced and may not have the resources to respond effectively to every instance. So there's all sorts of reasons for it. I think we see some evidence of programs, bullying prevention programs, working, though. And I think that is encouraging. And I think the ones that tend to work best, and the evidence shows is multi-component programs that address the whole school, that sort of have this universal component, school-wide component, and then more targeted strategies for those kids who may be at risk of bullying or may be at risk of being a target. And so that these multi-component, multi-tiered programs often work best. And there are some models for that. And what we hope to see is that more schools implement these programs so that we don't have instances, as the caller just alluded to, where you have really young kids being targeted and really suffering.
Mm-hmm. It is hard to believe that all of these kids left the classroom because of a bully and the school just didn't know how to deal with it. You would think that we've reached an age where we know a lot about this issue right now, and most schools would have had meetings to establish their policies.
Yeah, I would say in my experience, to have a class of 21, 11 out of 21 leave a classroom, that's atypical to have
right.
So many leave as a result of one bullying without the school having taken more substantial steps. And again, I don't know the specifics, but that seems atypical.
Pretty dramatic. Thanks, Dean. Rachel in Platteville. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I just have a comment to make on why I believe bullies are more popular from the playground in elementary school into politics, is that especially when students are young, they don't have a big reason or a big force for what they do with their life. And when someone has a force, which happens to be bullying, which is bad, that more students follow them or accept that or don't stand in the way and allow that to become a reason why they are popular.
What do you think, Professor?
I think that's right, and it echoes what an earlier caller said about sort of modeling. I think the caller is absolutely right that as long as bullies are and that bullying behavior is rewarded, then that encourages that bully and others. And I think that's why it's also important to study the others in a group. Bullying is a group dynamic. Bullies are looking for a response. And so the bystanders, we see different types of bystanders. Some bystanders are really enabling the bully and supporting the bully, while others may be more silent or supportive of the target but not standing up for the target. There are a lot of different roles played among bystanders, but I think we need to better understand that group that's really supporting and empowering the bully to continue.
Mm-hmm. And we also, it seems to me, I'm wondering how many effective programs there are in the country to deal with the people who are bullying, because their behavior has to be changed, right? We have to deal with them.
That's right. And I think one of the things, you know, it's one of the things that our report talked about is that zero tolerance policies, which have often been used in many school districts to respond, they don't seem to, they do not work, is the short answer. And I think that one of the findings from our examination of the evidence was that zero tolerance policies often have adverse consequences, and there's little evidence that they have any benefit. And I think sometimes that's been the reaction of schools on bullying and other behavior. Let's remove the child who is creating the problem. Now, it's, of course, important to ensure a safe environment for those who are targeted and for others, but removing a kid who may be acting out because of issues that he or she is confronting, isolating that child can often be harmful, or isolating that child with other aggressive kids where they might learn from each other and respond by becoming more aggressive is also not very productive. And so I think we need better ways to address bullying behavior. And then I think we need to, as we say in public health, move upstream and address behaviors before somebody starts bullying.
Right.
And that's about teaching tolerance and teaching that bullying behavior is not acceptable.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Rachel. Mike is next in Howard's Grove. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. I think that the nature of people who seek offices of power tend to be more bullies than not. School districts, I've known some district administrators who were classic bullies. In law enforcement, a lot of people who seek power because they are bullies seek positions from, you know, politics to wherever. So the tendency is it's not the students who are the bullies. In some cases, it's the people who are seeking positions of power who are the bullies, and that's an even bigger problem. The tendency is not the students.
Yeah, it's certainly another problem, and I think from my perspective, what interests me is what leads them to be those individuals. Is it bullying behavior that started earlier, or you know, what are the root causes of that, and how do we address that earlier?
Mm-hmm. And here's another person who wants to talk about the adult problem. Someone writes in, bullying is usually seen as a problem that has to do with children. What about the adults in the workplace? After 17 years of teaching in the same school, last year my principal passively bullied me in order to create the outcome he wanted. Many adults suffer quietly for fear of losing their jobs, regardless of any labor laws we have in this country. Please address this adult problem.
So my focus in my research is on children. I will say that in the workplace, and the comment alluded to this, there are labor laws, there are anti-harassment laws, anti-discrimination laws, The challenge with law always is ensuring that it is enforced and fully implemented. I think that bullying and aggressive behavior that's harmful to others in the workplace absolutely should be addressed. It hasn't been the focus of my work. I think that in some respects, at least in the law, there's a much longer history of addressing harms among adults than there is among children. We're sort of new to the game in a sense in looking at peer aggression and peer victimization and figuring out how the law should respond to that. And so that's an area where I think there's much more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Are there classic people who are picked on? Are you bullied for a whole host of reasons, or even some that we haven't even thought of, because you're too, I don't know, skinny, or you're too short, or you're whatever, you're too heavy, or too, why, who are the people who are the likely victims, or aren't there any one category?
So I can answer that two ways. First, in some respects, anyone can be targeted. The national surveys suggest anywhere from 18% to 31% of school-age children who have been involved in bullying, sort of a little bit lower numbers for cyberbullying. But there are some groups of students that are at greater risk. LGBT youth are bullied at a higher rate. Students with disabilities, mm-hmm. Obese and overweight students in many instances are targeted. We know that being a minority in whatever community you are leaves you more likely to be bullied, which is to say it's not necessarily race per se, but that if you are of a racial group that is a minority in that school, for example. We've seen some also cases of bullying based on religious beliefs. That's certainly, we've seen a rise sort of broader society. We've seen a rise in hate speech and hate crimes. And so that's sort of played out a little bit in the bullying context. Absolutely, you do see certain groups and vulnerable populations that are much more likely to be targeted.
Yes. Thanks, Mike, for your call. Dean in northern Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, I'm going to cover 6 decades. I'll talk fast. I'll let you know every time I flip to the next subject. Number one, Catholic school. I was bullied psychologically, emotionally by the nuns. And, of course, they passed that on to my classmates. I finally flunked 6th grade, and I got back with a new whole set of kids, and I wasn't bullied anymore because they hadn't been taught by the nuns. I never spanked it with a ruler, but it was an emotional and a psychological and a mental battering, and I was always constantly being threatened that they're going to call my parents. My parents, I had a structured home. We had to fold our jeans when we got home, that type of structure, and I loved home compared to the way I was bullied by the nuns, and I said I can do a better job than that. Jumping forward now a couple of decades, I'm teaching high school. First thing I said is, kids, you throw nothing in my class, and you do not call anybody any names. That was number one. And I never had a kid in 14 years pick on another kid. They picked on me a couple of times, but not. I mean, that was foremost in my life. Moving on, not teaching. Decades later, I have 3 children with the same woman, okay, full siblings. I have gotten to the most horrific bullying that I had ever had seen in 50 years of life. I went to social services 3 times a year at least. I called, I need help, I need help, I need help, I need help. And all they could say, well, if we could just get this kid from 6 to 7, okay. Then we get to 14 to 19, okay. As soon as they get to 18, then we can put them in jail. I said, I don't want to put my kids in jail. I need help. And these are children that I never spanked. They never heard a foul word out of me, And the mother, every word was F, G, D, J, C, on and on.
All right, so who's doing the bullying?
I want help.
Excuse me.
Social services.
Right. Who was doing the bullying, your wife or the kids?
Say it again?
Who was doing the bullying, the wife or your kids or both?
The mother.
The
kids walked on eggshells.
Okay.
I walked on eggshells.
Okay, all right, so you couldn't get help from social services.
Sure, social services. And all I could get out of them is get them, like I said, from 11 to 12. I mean, them to 6 to 7.
Right.
The kids were great in school because that was their salvation. They did well in school, and I couldn't get help from the teachers because, oh, your kids are great. I said, they know they're great. This is their timeout or their escape.
All right. I need to cut you there because we got a lot of calls, and we could go on with this. But is this an indication that somebody in social services is failing him, that this isn't a story you haven't heard before, or what, Professor?
So I think, you know, one of the striking things is we often use bullying in a lot of different contexts, and I think maybe it's helpful. I think what the caller was talking about, about starting with nuns 50 years ago and now sort of parents, is sort of an adult behavior towards children, and that's obviously important. I mean, we have a long history of on a law, policy, programmatic level responding to child maltreatment, and work still to be done in that area, of course. But what we're talking about, I think, primarily, certainly with the study and bullying in the schools, and is really peer interaction. So unwanted aggressive behavior by one child or adolescent or group of youth against another. And I think that's really the focus of this study and of current anti-bullying work, because at least as it's understood, you know, that sort of adult action towards kids that's harmful, there are other processes for dealing with that. And again, those might need work. But I think what this study is trying to call attention to is that sort of dynamic among peers, among youth.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jean. Monica in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Monica. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Okay,
hi.
Sorry. I just wanted to share. My daughter was in a class in fourth grade with a young man who had a cleft palate, who was being bullied by a group of the cool girls, which was not my daughter. And she and a friend saw this, and it really upset them, but they knew if they intervened directly, the bullying would turn on them. So what they started doing was every time he was being harassed and almost in tears, they'd walk up and say something nice to him. And they diffused it so that he stopped looking like he was so vulnerable because he had friends. And they changed the whole atmosphere around him because he didn't feel he had nobody to back him up.
Mm-hmm.
And it never got physical, and the girls never turned their attention on my daughter, but her teacher related to me that these two girls changed the atmosphere in the whole room by just being extra nice to the kid that was being picked on, and that she had observed this going on because she couldn't get them to stop, because 10-year-old girls can be very subtly mean.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just such a marvelous thing. And when I asked my daughter about it, she said, well, isn't that what you're supposed to do when people get picked on?
Huh. She just she knew that from the way she was raised, probably, huh?
Well, and she was very sensitive to other people. Unfortunately, when she started getting bullied in sixth grade, it didn't happen for her. And she was allowing it to happen without complaining because she just kept saying, well, those kids don't have the nice home I do, and those kids don't have... And I said, I don't care. They can't hit you every time they see you either.
Right.
And we got, but the school intervened immediately, and it stopped completely.
Hmm.
So, but I just was really, kids can change that if they're given the power to back up their friends.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Kids need to be given the power to do the right thing, Professor Tadros.
Yeah, I think we see, I mean, that sounds like a really good example of both the school and that individual teacher really being attuned to bullying dynamics and being responsive. And as far as her daughter, I mean, these are the instances that we should celebrate in childhood. When a child's brave enough to stand up to a bully, that's what should be rewarded. And those should be, and sounds like it was, sort of our proudest moments.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call, Monica. Nancy in Grafton, hi.
Good afternoon. When I was a little kid, probably sixth grade, we were farmers, and so we had to ride a bus to go to school. Well, there were a couple of boys that were picking on a girl who had some handicap, and they'd take her cap off and throw it on the ball around. And so finally, I stood up and I said, "That's enough, that's enough." And the bus driver stopped the bus. And he said, "You get off that bus. Me, I'm supposed to get off because I'm opening up my big mouth and trying to stop them picking on that girl."
Huh.
Well, I said, "I'm not getting off the bus." So that night, after the bus route, he came over to the farm, and he came down the barn where my dad was milking cows. And he said, "I can't do anything with that big mouth." He said, "She's got her mouth open, and she won't. She's interrupting, you know." And because I told the bus driver, I said, "Oh, it's all right if you sit up there and you sing dirty songs and you tell dirty jokes." There was a high school boy that sat back of him in the first seat back of the bus driver, and so that's what they did.
Yeah.
And then next morning, my dad came upstairs with a strap. I got the worst
gobsmacking
I ever got, ever.
Oh.
And but to this day, I still stand up for those who can't speak for themselves, and I don't care. I just think that my dad did the wrong thing.
Yes, he did.
After a while, he found out about this bus driver, and that I was right and the bus driver was wrong, and he felt bad about that.
Mm.
But that was what I lived through when I was a little girl.
Mm. Professor Chadris.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful story of courage.
Yes.
From a child. And I think it's a reminder, and I see this in my work, not just on bullying, but in other areas of child well-being, that we often don't credit what a child says, and we're inclined to dismiss it when it contradicts what an adult says. And maybe this is a good reminder that we need to listen to and take seriously what children say.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for your call, Nancy. I'm amazed. Once again, the memories are just so fresh, even though it happened a long time ago. Why bullying needs more efforts to stop it is our topic this hour. Professor Jonathan Chadris, professor of law at Georgia State University. He served as a member of a committee, and it's on the biological and psychosocial effects of peer victimization and lessons for bullying prevention. This was of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. He's also recently co-authored Human Rights in Children's Literature, Imagination, and the Narrative of Law. We have time for a few more phone calls, and a line is open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where if you like us, then we'll send you little notices about upcoming shows. It's kind of a handy thing. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Someone sent an email wondering, Professor, how do we recognize and become self-aware of our own behavior and if we ourselves are bullies?
Well, I think that one of the critical pieces of bullying is whether it's unwanted. And I think becoming more attuned to whether what we are saying or doing has that is embraced and is welcomed by the people we're interacting with, or whether it's unwanted. And that, you know, unwanted aggressive behavior is one of the critical components of bullying. The other piece and the other way is that bullying operates in a space where there's a perceived or actual power imbalance. So if you happen to be in a position of power in interacting with others, then your aggressive behavior may well be more likely to be unwanted, and it may be taking advantage of that power imbalance. And so that's another way to become attuned to it.
Nikki, our next caller in Elkhorn. Hello, Nikki.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling from touch base on the whole bullying thing because there's something that has stuck with me. I'm 24 years old now, and in third grade, my family, we moved from Milwaukee Public Schools, which we transferred to Cudahy. And in Milwaukee, of course, there's always a group of mixed kids. There's always, you know, white, black, Mexican, whatever. But in Cudahy at the time, it was very not mixed. And at that time in third grade, I was the only black kid in my school, one of the only black kids in my class, should I say. And there was this boy that I can never forget. He was definitely very physical with the bullying to the point where he even called me the N-word.
Ugh.
And to this day, again, I'm 24 years old from third grade. I'm 24 now. I will never forget that because it stuck with me to the point where I moved from the city and I'm in the suburbs now, but even to this day, I'm very cautious as to where I go. I like to make sure that there's always a mixed crowd, that I'm comfortable, because I don't like being the only, you know, minority there, because it makes me think of that time again, and I get very, very self-conscious to the point where sometimes I don't even want to go out. I don't want to be around people. I'd rather just be by myself. And that, it really, it still hurts my feelings to this day because you still see, you know, the racism with the bullying, and it's just something that I don't like to see, and it's something that people today should not put up with. People should be teaching their kids differently,
right,
making sure that they're, you know, on the right track and being nice and being friends to help with everybody, just anybody, no matter what their race or their gender, if there's a disability or anything. None of that should ever matter when it comes to kids and bullying. Like, parents really need to teach their kids better.
Hear ye, and you should in no way feel uncomfortable at this point, so many years later. Well, what's to be done about this situation? And look, here we go again. Nikki remembers this from third grade, and it's influenced her behavior, you know, 20 years later.
And I think we see that over and over again, that, and I appreciate the caller sharing these stories. I think it's courageous just sharing the story this many years later. These aren't easy memories and experiences to relive. So I really appreciate her sharing this story. And I think we see the same thing in these stories as we see in the research, which is the mental health consequences, the experience of that early trauma sticks with many individuals well into adulthood. And,
mm-hmm.
And that is why we really need to address this early. And the other point that she made that I think is critical, I caught the tail end of your earlier speaker who was talking about in the war context that others are dehumanized, and that's what enables us to act in really horrific ways in many cases in war settings. Now, obviously, this is not a war setting, but there is a devaluation of the other, and that comes back to sort of this critical idea that we really need to do a better job of teaching tolerance, teaching acceptance, and teaching commonality, and not devaluing others. Mm.
And perhaps thinking about reintegrating our schools. It was interesting what she said, that she went from a community where people were mixed and there were people, you know, of all different kinds of backgrounds, and she went to a place that was more homogenous. There is something to be said for a diverse environment in schools.
Absolutely. And we know, and we've seen it in the news recently, that we have a lot of work still to be done on integrating schools.
We sure do. All right, we have time for, I don't know, one or two, if people can talk quickly. Richard in River Falls, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hey, listen, I would just want to make one comment or a couple comments anyway on this whole issue. First of all, I think that the whole issue of bullying has been turned from a moral issue into a political issue. And just like all political issues, there's always two sides. When it was a moral issue, there was only one side, and that was the side of the originator of morality. Since 1973, we have lost the moral compass of this nation. You talk about what's the word, tolerance? Some of the most intolerant people are the ones that are always screaming tolerance. So what used to be immoral is now moral to many people who look at it as a political situation. All the money that we spend on professors and studies and all this sort of thing, it's not going to do. We got to get back to biblical truth and morality. Thank you for listening.
All right. Thanks very much, Richard, for your call. That'll do it for our show. And we thank you, Professor Todres, so much for being with us. We'll post the article on our Facebook page and carry on with your important work, sir.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Our pleasure. Professor Jonathan Todres, he's a professor of law at Georgia State University, and he was on the committee of the Biological and Psychosocial Effects of Peer Victimization, Lessons for Bullying Prevention of the National National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this program and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in lovely downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock.